A passel of pomp and a circus of circumstance. Historic convention coverage from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Every 4 years, as summer ends, the United States turns its attention to two chosen cities. Why? The two cities play host to the two major political party conventions. But what goes on inside these conventions? And why in recent years has so much gone on outside the convention halls? I'm Amy Goodman. The Pacifica Radio Archives, the nation's largest public radio archive, comb through its vaults in an attempt to learn more about the history of party conventions and to also learn how the Pacifica Radio Network covered these conventions over the years. From the protests in Chicago in 1968 to the shadow conventions in 2000, Pacifica has been there, reporting on the goings-on from its uniquely independent perspective. Pacifica's mission is to bring to the public voices often unheard. Only by hearing voices from as many perspectives as possible is the listener able to fully participate in the national debate. And whether those voices belong to the two major parties, the Communist Party of America, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, or the Green Party, Pacifica has tried to put a microphone where no other media sources will. Throughout this program, we'll hear archive sound that both gives us an understanding of the mechanisms that run the party conventions and that also show the growth and development of the Pacifica Radio Network.
Let's waste no time measuring the unfortunate man in the White House against our specifications.
A woman journalist there said to me, "I know nothing of your American politics."
Will the convention be, will the sergeant at arms enforce order in the convention?
We are selecting the head of the most powerful nation on earth, the man who literally will hold in his hands the power of survival or destruction, of freedom or slavery.
Hubert Humphrey was in Atlantic City. The crackers that you voted for were in Atlantic City. What did they do for you when you wanted to sit down? They were quiet. They were silent. They said, "Don't rock the boat. You might get Goldwater elected."
During the first hour of this program, we'll look at conventions from 1936 to 1968. But before we go to the big names, to the voices we all know, like John F. Kennedy and Malcolm X, we need to start at the beginning. We have to ask ourselves, what are the conventions? When did they start? In September of 1831, the Anti-Masonic Party, which existed for the primary purpose of eliminating Freemasonry in the United States, holds the first national nominating convention with a platform and delegates. 2 months later, the National Republican Party follows suit and holds their own convention in Baltimore. And in May of the following year, the Democratic Republican Party also holds a national nominating convention in Baltimore. These nominating conventions take root and go on every 4 years from then on. Their main function is to bring together representatives of their party or delegates to nominate a candidate for president and vice president, and to also debate over and approve a party platform for the next 4 years. KPFA, Pacifica's first radio station, was founded in 1949. But it was not until 1964 that there was a concerted and extensive effort to cover the major party conventions. But the Pacifica Radio Archives has inside its vaults audio dating from the beginning periods of radio in this country. One of the discoveries made inside the vast vault of the archives is a documentary made in 1972 by KPFK producer Mike Hodell about the major party conventions from 1936 to 1972. Here, he introduces the 1936 Democratic National Convention.
Franklin D. Roosevelt is serving his first full term when the 1936 Democratic Party Convention opens that June morning in Philadelphia. That first evening is 3 hours of Democratic oratory, an FDR festival, a chronicling of the New Deal, and praise for its accomplishments both real and theoretical. The keynote speaker, the senator from Kentucky, Alban Barkley, rubs 12 years of Republican failure into the faces of the delegates, Then he scrubs those faces clean with the washcloth of the New Deal and the name of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
My friends, who is it that opposes the program of the New Deal? Who is it that raises the black flag of revolt in this great crisis of the American people? Not the farmers, not the laboring man, not the homeowner, not the honest investor, not the children of the nation, not those who desire that their government shall be the agency of all the people, rather than to have its powers twisted and warped in behalf of a few of the American people.
Then comes Friday, and with it the words of Judge John Mack, who had nominated FDR in 1932. Judge Mack finds some new words, but the theme is the same. He says, "I give you as your candidate no longer a citizen of one state, but a son of all 48 states, Franklin D. Roosevelt." The name touches off a demonstration that lasts an hour and 4 minutes. The meticulous New York Times notes that the 1932 demonstration had lasted 45 minutes. So the stage is set. At 12:42 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Saturday, the president is officially renominated. His running mate, John Nance Garner of Texas, also is renominated. Saturday evening, both men appear at the convention. FDR accepts renomination with the following words.
"I cannot with candor tell you that all is well with the world. Clouds of suspicion, tides of ill will and intolerance gather darkly in many places. In our own land, we enjoy indeed a fullness of life that is greater than that of most nations. But the rush of modern civilization itself has raised for us new difficulties, new problems, which must be solved if we are to preserve to the United States the political and the economic freedom for which Washington and Jefferson planned and fought."
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
So speaks Franklin D. Roosevelt, accepting renomination. It is a prelude to victory in November. FDR would continue. Who is Wendell Willkie? What are his beliefs? Well, he's the president of the Commonwealth and Southern Corporation, and he gained prominence through his attacks on the Tennessee Valley Authority's competition with his company's interests in the South. As one Washingtonian puts it, he owns two farms and works them. That's ominous. And being from Indiana and a lawyer by profession, there's no doubt he's a presidential candidate. All Indiana lawyers are. Willkie's presidential campaign doesn't get underway until just a few months before the 1940 convention. He made several speeches attacking the New Deal as a threat to freedom, as seeking to increase the powers of government. He has urged modification of the tax laws, a curb on New Deal regulatory agencies, a better attitude of government toward business. On foreign policy issues, Willkie has not hidden his sympathy for the German conquered and the German threatened. He has opposed American intervention in the war. He advocates national defense not as a step toward war, but as a protection against it. The political bosses can't stop Wendell Willkie. Willkie's running mate is Republican Senate leader Charles McNary of Oregon, known as a farm spokesman. Wilkie had not met his running mate prior to the convention. But neither Wendell Wilkie nor Charles McNary can stand against Franklin D. Roosevelt. Once again, the Republican hopes will be dashed against the fortress of the New Deal. Franklin D. Roosevelt, after 8 years in the White House, is virtually certain to run for re-election. There have been moves to stop him from going after a third term, moves by Postmaster General James Farley, who directed FDR's two prior campaigns. Senators Glass and Byrd of Virginia, Senator Clark of Missouri, Senator McCarran of Nevada. They see a third term as possibly leading to dictatorship, possibly to life tenure, since an incumbency makes possible the creation of an irresistible political machine. The president keeps silent about the possibility of a third term. He sends the convention a message given to the 1,094 delegates by convention chairman Senator Alvin Barkley. The message? The delegates are free to choose any candidate they wish. But FDR's Secretary of Commerce, Harry Hopkins, stalks the convention, persuading the delegates that the war clouds over Europe mark the gravest crisis since the Civil War. To meet that crisis, says Hopkins, we must put our faith in a continued presidency, in FDR. And the delegates listen, and they nod. FDR will get his third term. But those opposing a third term are able to halt a stampede. They prevent nomination by acclamation. With the president finally renominated, the focus shifts to the vice presidential choice. Roosevelt's two-time running mate, John Garner of Texas, has swung away from a belief in the New Deal. Another man must be chosen. FDR's choice? Secretary of Agriculture Henry Wallace. A former Republican, son of President Harding's Secretary of Agriculture, Henry Wallace does not arouse the delegates' cheers. There is muttering from the floor, muttering of high-handed White House bullying of stormtrooper tactics, but FDR prevails in his choice. FDR himself does not attend this Democratic convention. He sits in the White House before a radio microphone, speaking to the delegates and to Eleanor Roosevelt, gathered in Chicago. They listen as FDR's words boom from a loudspeaker.
It is with a very full heart that I speak tonight. I must confess that I do so with mixed feelings, because I find myself, as almost everyone does, sooner or later in his lifetime, in a conflict between deep personal desire for retirement on the one hand, and that quiet, invisible thing called conscience. Nearly every American is willing to do his share or her share to defend the United States. It is neither just nor efficient to permit that task to fall upon any one section or any one group. For every section and every group depend for their existence upon the survival of the nation as a whole. Lying awake as I have on many nights, I have asked myself whether I have the right, as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, to call on men and women to serve their country or to train themselves to serve, and at the same time decline to serve my country in my personal capacity if I am called upon to do so by the people of my country.
Thomas E. Dewey comes to the 1948 Republican Convention in Philadelphia, fighting not only the opponents within his own party, but also a tradition. Never in its history has the GOP renominated a presidential also-ran. The smell of victory is in the air. The traditional keynote speakers scent the Democrats' weaknesses. Congressperson Claire Booth Luce of Connecticut spells it out for the cheering delegates.
Let's waste no time measuring the unfortunate man in the White House against our specifications. Mr. Truman's time is short and his situation is hopeless. Frankly, frankly, he's a gone goose. But before he goes, I think we should admit that we owe him several debts of gratitude. We should be grateful to Mr. Truman that he tried to be president in 1944, and that with the gallant aid of the big city bosses, Kelly and Flynn and Pendergast and Haig, he didn't fail. If he had failed, our president today would be Mr. Henry Wallace. Providence rode straight with crooked lines when the Pendergast machine gave us Mr. Truman, the colorless Mr. Truman, instead of the red Hank Wallace. And I think we should all be grateful, too, that Mr. Truman has so little dramatic talent. When there's a slump at the ballot box office, a real New Deal hero must be able to chew up the scenery. But Mr. Truman is a man of phlegm and not of fire. He just can't read those old Bob Sherwood lines with the oomph that it takes to get the curtain calls in November. Now, you know, nobody would call Mr. Truman's 3 years in office the pause that refreshes. But they have given us a breathing space in which to refresh our memories on a great hunk of recent democratic history. Consider the makeup of the Democratic Party at its operational level. It's less a party than a podge. It's a mishmash of die-hard and fighting factions. Now you take the extreme right or the Jim Crow wing of the Democratic Party. Now that wing is led by a lot of lynch-loving Bourbons, white-shirted race supremacists of the Bilbo ilk. At its best, that wing of the party is conservative, but it's seldom to be found at its best. It's generally waging a last-ditch fight on some progressive issue of national health or housing or education or labor. And at its worst, this Jim Crow wing of the Democratic Party is the most reactionary element in our American life. It's anti-Semitic, it's anti-Catholic, it's anti-foreign, it's anti-diluvian.
Chances are good. Dewey and Warren are confident that their campaign will end in victory. They had a united party, while the Democrats are deeply divided. Even the New York Times sees reasons for Republican optimism in 1948. And the Chicago Tribune will go even further come election night. But the day after that, Harry S. Truman will return to the White House. And Thomas E. Dewey, who beat one Republican jinx, will return to the ranks, once again, a private citizen.
Mike O'Dell, KPFK producer from the 1970s. On February 7th, 1950, the junior senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy, stood before the Women's Club of Wheeling, West Virginia, and waved a piece of paper, claiming on it he had 205 names of known communists who worked within the federal government. And thus, McCarthy elevated himself to unofficial leader of the crusade against communism. Move forward to October of that same year as the Korean War begins, with Red China announcing to the world it will not stand idly by as American forces cross the 38th parallel. And just 1 month later, in November, during the midterm elections, the Republicans gain 5 Senate and 31 House seats, including a win by the freshman senator from California, Richard M. Nixon. Although the Democrats still control both, the shift to conservatism is well underway. By March of 1951, Just 6 months after the beginning of the Korean War, Defense Secretary George Marshall announces the U.S. armed forces are now twice the size they were at the beginning of the conflict. In April, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg are found guilty and sentenced to death for conspiracy to commit espionage for the Soviet Union. Later that same month, General MacArthur is removed from his post by President Truman for arguing for complete victory in Korea. Then, on the 19th of the month, General MacArthur, speaking before a joint session of Congress, urges the U.S. to expand the war into communist China. Take all of this information in and understand that when General Dwight David Eisenhower, the former Supreme Commander of Allied forces during the war, makes known his willingness to run for president on the Republican ticket, the mood of the country is such the race for president of the United States is essentially over before it even gets started. And so it is at the 1952 Republican National Convention, Governor Theodore McClellan places Ike's name in nomination as the Republican candidate.
When I visited Italy briefly 2 months ago, on the occasion of one of their national holidays, their most important, the communists in Genoa were staging one of their demonstrations. A woman journalist there said to me, "I know nothing of your American politics, but I can tell you this. There is one man these communists hate with a depth and violence greater than they have for anyone else." And she mentioned the name of this same gallant American.
After the first ballot, Ike is only 9 votes short of the nomination. A 19-vote switch on the second ballot seals it, giving Dwight David Eisenhower and his running mate, Richard M. Nixon, a proper send-off as Ike begins his march on Washington. The 1956 DNC comes to Chicago prepared to try again to win Adlai Stevenson the presidency. He carried only 9 states in 1952, and a seeming unity between Stevenson and former President Truman has once again erupted into a feud. But despite Truman's antipathy, the delegates will give Stevenson the nomination. Besides Truman, the only major opposition to Stevenson comes from the South, which is fighting his civil rights plank. But like the candidate himself, the civil rights platform will prevail despite the South. A young, little-known senator from Massachusetts named Kennedy gains national recognition when he nominates Adlai Stevenson.
We have come today not merely to nominate a Democratic candidate, but to nominate a president of the United States. Sometimes in the heat of a political convention, we forget the grave responsibilities which we as delegates possess. For we here today are selecting a man who must be more than something of a good candidate, more than a good politician or a good liberal or a good conservative. We are selecting the head of the most powerful nation on earth, the man who literally will hold in his hands the power of survival or destruction, of freedom or slavery. We are selecting here today the man who, for the next 4 years, will be guiding for good or evil, for better or worse, the destinies of our nation and, to a large extent, the destinies of the free world. Ladies and gentlemen of this convention, it is now my privilege to present to this convention, as a candidate for President of the United States, the name of the man uniquely qualified, by virtue of his compassion, his conscience, and his courage, to follow in the great tradition of Jefferson, Jackson, Wilson, Roosevelt, and the man from Independence. Fellow delegates, I give you the man from Libertyville, the next Democratic nominee and our next President of the United States, Adlai E. Stevenson.
Future President John F. Kennedy. On the other side of the aisle, at the 1956 Republican National Convention, the mood is, for the most part, one of absolute confidence. It looks very likely President Eisenhower will again spend 4 years residing in the White House. Ike beat Adlai Stevenson in 1952, and there's no reason to think he shouldn't be able to do it once more. Here, he speaks to the delegates after receiving renomination.
This is a good time to think about the future, for this convention is celebrating its 100th anniversary. And the centennial is an occasion not just for recalling the inspiring past, but the point is this: our policies are right today only as they are designed to stand the test of tomorrow. The great Norwegian Henrik Ibsen once wrote, "I hold that man is in the right who is most clearly in league with the future." Today I want to demonstrate the truth of a single proposition. The Republican Party is the party of the future.
And he was right. In November, Ike and Nixon will handily defeat Adlai Stevenson. During the 1960 presidential primaries, the United States was increasingly overwhelmed by the threat of communism. Strains in the country's relationship with the Soviet Union had come to a breaking point when, in May, the Soviet Union shot down an American U-2 spy plane. In San Francisco, the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, was railing against supposed communists and communist supporters, including the Pacifica Radio Network. And a week before the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, the U.S. announces it will cut Cuba sugar imports by 95%. Despite all this, Pacifica makes its first moves as a radio network to cover a national party convention. But staying true to Pacifica's mission of bringing forth those voices rarely heard and oftentimes intentionally left out of the national dialogue, Pacifica station WBAI covered the 17th convention of the Communist Party of the United States in Harlem, New York.
The exciting era in which we live is characterized by growing superiority of socialism over capitalism, by the building of communism in the world's first socialist state, by the liberation of colonial peoples in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, by Sputniks and Lunics. The achievements of mankind's noblest dreams are the talk of every town and hamlet, New York included. They are having a profound effect upon every aspect of human endeavor. The importance of our party cannot be overestimated. Small as it is, temporarily, it carries the banner of the future. We don't need to worry about our convention being historic. The crude and transparent attempts of the capitalist press to intervene and divide our ranks to set one personality against another are all backhanded testimony to the importance of our convention and of the American Communist Party. Comrades, we pledge here in New York to do everything possible to make this a great convention, a convention with confidence in the people of America, confidence in the socialist achievements of the whole world, and confidence in our own working class, in the unity of Negro and white, to march forward to new heights of achievements.
It cannot be stressed enough the courage it took to broadcast the Communist Convention during that period of the Red Scare. It is acts like this that contribute to the public's perception of Pacifica, one of being fearless and sometimes a little too fearless. But this is precisely the mission of Pacifica, and its unique format, the first in the country of being entirely listener-supported, enables the brave program directors to make decisions like this. In Los Angeles, Senator John F. Kennedy rolls into the convention after a series of primary victories and momentum that cannot be stopped. The candidate closest to him in delegates is Lyndon Johnson from Texas. Despite their mutual dislike, out of courtesy and also thinking he'll refuse, Kennedy offers Johnson the vice presidency. Johnson accepts, and the Kennedy-Johnson ticket is born. In Chicago, at the Republican National Convention, Eisenhower's vice president, Richard Nixon, is in charge, negotiating a platform he can live with, while also acquiescing to his main rival, Governor Rockefeller of New York. The platform includes a controversial plank on defense, which President Eisenhower sees as a repudiation of his work. Feeling slighted by his protege, Eisenhower does not attend the convention, but does send along a telegraph congratulating Nixon, read to the convention floor by House Minority Leader Charles Halleck.
This campaign will not be easy. Indeed, it will be a struggle right down to election day. But I am confident that you will attract to the cause of maintaining good government a large majority of the independent voters and even a great many discerning Democrats. These, together with the united efforts of all the members of our party, will ensure victory at the polls, signed Dwight D. Eisenhower.
But Ike's brave words are in vain. It's a tough campaign, but in November, Nixon and Lodge will lose by a razor-thin edge to John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson.